Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Loving Someone Who Has Dementia, How to Find Hope While Coping with Stress and Grief, by Pauline Boss, PhD. Narrated by Leslie Howard. Preface. I often thought about writing a book for families, but I was busy writing for academicians and professionals. As a retired professor, however, I have more options, and this message on my voicemail cinched it. I'm calling to make an appointment. Basically, I just have one question to ask you. How does a caretaker care for oneself when the work is so hard to care for the other? I suppose that's the million-dollar question. That caller convinced me that you all deserve an answer to this agonizing question, yet many of you don't have the time or energy for therapy. I write this book, then, for the millions of you who now find yourselves asking the same question. With the demands of caregiving, how can I possibly take care of myself? Researchers have found that caregiving can be dangerous to your health. It makes sense that in an aging society, caregiving becomes a public health issue. It's urgent that the rest of us help in any way we can to support you. Toward this end, I write this book. It is not about how to give day-to-day hands-on care. Rather, it provides a new way to help you find meaning and hope in your relationship with someone you love who has dementia. The goal is to help you increase your resiliency, your ability to withstand and grow even stronger despite the stress and grief. This book focuses specifically on a new lens or theory that can lessen the stress when a family member is here but not here. How did I get the idea for this new theoretical lens? In the early 1970s, while studying family therapy with psychiatrist Carl Whitaker in my doctoral studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I noticed that families with problem children often had psychologically absent fathers. They were there, but not there, complaining, as fathers often did in the early 70s, that the child was the mother's business, not his, and didn't we know that he had to get back to work? Whitaker, of course, did not agree, nor did I. Relatively quickly, I came to see that any family member, not just a father, could be psychologically absent while physically present. In a sociology seminar, also at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I began to develop the theory of ambiguous loss, and it became the topic of my doctoral dissertation in 1975, which focused on families of pilots missing in action after the Vietnam War. This was ambiguous loss of the physical type. In the 1980s, now a professor at the University of Minnesota, I tested the theory of ambiguous loss again, this time with family caregivers whose loved ones had Alzheimer's disease. This was ambiguous loss of the psychological type. Ever since, in research and clinical work, I've studied the effects on relationships when one person is psychologically absent, when a person you love is physically here, but gone psychologically. Along with teaching, research, and clinical work, I have trained professionals who work with the psychological losses of dementia, as well as those who work with families of the physically missing, in New York after 9/11, in Kosovo, in the Gulf Coast after Katrina, and in Miami after the Haitian earthquake. I'll continue to provide ideas that broaden guidelines to be more culturally inclusive. My training of professionals continues today. The research today is conducted primarily by a second generation of scholars, some of whom studied with me at the University of Minnesota, but many from around the world are now testing the theory of ambiguous loss in other cultures. I couldn't be happier about this. In 2009, at the beginning of winter, I began writing this book, motivated by my long-standing belief that if people can understand a problem, they are better able to cope with it. The theory of ambiguous loss is grounded in that premise. A year has passed, and snow is falling again. It's a welcome quiet in the midst of what are stressful times for the millions of people who are now caring for a loved one who has dementia. May this book, and the ideas within it, prove useful to you in your search for meaning and hope. Pauline Boss, St. Paul, Minnesota. December 2010. Introduction. Here's the problem. As of 2011, there were 5.4 million Americans living with Alzheimer's disease. The number increases if the other diseases and conditions that cause irreversible dementia are included. Every 69 seconds, someone in America today develops Alzheimer's disease. By 2050, the rate will increase to every 33 seconds. Said another way, few families now, and fewer yet in the future, will be untouched by Alzheimer's or other dementias. More women than men are susceptible to dementia, primarily because they tend to live longer. In addition, race, ethnicity, education, and location also influence the prevalence of dementias. One fact, however, is consistent. Any increase in dementia leads to an increased need for caregivers. What do researchers tell us about them? As of 2010, there were 14.9 million unpaid caregivers in the United States. Not surprisingly, 60% are female. Wives, daughters, daughters-in-law, granddaughters, and friends. More surprisingly, the typical caregiver is relatively young. According to a 2011 report of the Alzheimer's Association, 67% of caregivers are between the ages of 35 and 64. On either side of this largest group, caregivers range from very young, 10% under the age of 35, to very old, 23% 65 or older. Wives and daughters do most of the caregiving for persons with dementia. They also report the most negative effects on their own well-being. Many caregivers find themselves in what is called the sandwich generation, simultaneously caring for young children and elderly parents. Tending both to younger and older generations, and perhaps also to a marriage, such caregivers find themselves pulled from all sides, squeezed for time, and struggling with divided loyalties, a recipe for high anxiety and extreme stress. If someone you love has dementia, this book represents a psychological journey toward meaning and hope. We begin with ideas to help you understand why dementia can be so confusing and stressful, then follow with guidelines to help you cope and stay resilient. Throughout, my message to you is that participating in a less-than-perfect relationship can deepen your humanity. My primary focus is on how to find meaning in dementia's unique kind of loss, what I call ambiguous loss. Dementia is a prime example of ambiguous, unclear loss. Making sense of it is especially difficult because a loved one is simultaneously here and gone. It's as though there's a stranger in the house. The relationship you once had is thus deeply altered. Without clarity or clear finality, you're held in limbo, blocked from grieving and making sense of it all. Because of the incongruence between absence and presence, ambiguous loss is the most stressful kind of loss. Clients tell me that even a death in the family would be less painful. There is certainty in death, and thus more opportunity for finding meaning in it. Who is this book for? This book is meant for anyone who cares for, or cares about, a person who has some kind of dementia. It's for you if you're doing hands-on or long-distance caregiving. It's for you if you are experiencing sadness and anxiety due to caring about someone with dementia. It is also for others, friends, relatives, clergy, medical professionals, who want a resource that discusses the complexity of a caregiver's loss and what to do about it. In an aging society, we are all vulnerable to the need either to give care or to receive it. It's not an isolated problem. Until there is a cure, dementia, regardless of its source, remains a 21st century epidemic, and we are all in it together. With only a few degrees of separation, we now all know someone who has dementia or who is caregiving. Yet even when it's close by, many people turn their heads and don't notice the frequency of what's happening. Until we all pay more attention, until we see caring as important, we are marginalizing and isolating the family caregivers who contribute so much to keeping dementia patients at home for as long as possible. Until recently, families have tended to designate one family member, thus the term primary caregiver, to do the work of caregiving while the rest of the family and community carried on with their lives. They likely breathed a sigh of relief when they didn't have to put in what is called the 36-hour day. But now it's time for all of us to acknowledge, appreciate, and directly help caregivers. The one down the street, the one in your congregation, the one in your family. Because simply put, it takes a village. One person can't do it alone and stay healthy. What often endangers the emotional and physical health of caregivers is their isolation. Unlike dementia, this problem can be fixed. We can do better. We can try harder to understand the caregiving experience, and that is what this book is for. Caregivers are a devoted army of family and friends who provide most of the dementia care and who work for no pay and no benefits. They save our government and taxpayers millions of dollars by reducing the time dementia patients spend in institutional care settings. Surely we can pay closer attention to their contributions. Policymakers, community leaders, neighbors, friends, and relatives need to acknowledge their work and lend a hand so that caregivers can stay more socially connected. After all, human connection is what keeps us healthy. What I mean by dementia. Dementia, whether from illness or injury, is a condition of the brain that leads to the loss of remembering, thinking, reasoning, and judgment. Gradually, even the simplest tasks of daily living, dressing, feeding, and toileting, require help. Dementia itself is not a disease, but rather a group of symptoms that results from other diseases or conditions. The most common is Alzheimer's disease, a fatal disease that accounts for over half of all cases of dementia. Dementia changes one's personality, mood, and behavior, so existing relationships are strained. Thus, dementia is more than a physiological condition. It is a relational condition that deeply affects those who care for and care about the patient. What is relevant to the thesis of this book is the factor of incurability, which creates the deepest and longest-lasting ambiguity and stress for caregivers. Approximately 50 causes of dementia exist now, some treatable, some not. In this book, I limit my discussion to those that are as yet not curable. Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia or tiny strokes, Lewy body dementia, frontal lobe dementia, Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease, AIDS dementia complex, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, what is also called mad cow disease, among others. The lack of resolution is what makes the case of dementia so compelling in the study of human resiliency. How do people live with a loved one who is gone psychologically, but still here physically? In the absence of a cure or the finality of death, how do people live in this shadow land? These are the questions that I will try to answer in subsequent chapters. Before we proceed, I need to add a note about traumatic brain injury, which can also lead to dementia. After much thought, I've decided not to address the ambiguous loss of traumatic brain injury in this book, even though it is the signature wound from our wars in the Middle East. Why? Because progressive dementia is not always the outcome of traumatic brain injury, and because younger patients and their spouses or parents differ from older patients and their families in their dynamics and developmental life stages. Having worked with the families of these young people wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan, I see them very differently. They are not families in the last half of life, but young families trying to build a life together despite terrible wounds in both body and mind. Although there are commonalities, their story deserves a book of its own. Why I'm writing this book. Although dementia at any stage is a difficult experience for anyone, it is especially stressful for those of us who like to be in charge of our own destinies. Accustomed to being in control, we feel helpless about dementia. Yet there is a way to feel better. When we can't control the dementia, we can still control how we perceive and manage the situation, and therein lies a caregiver's window for hope. Although I'm not technically a boomer, I relate to their generation of can-do people accustomed to finding solutions to problems. As a Swiss-American Protestant professor who was socialized to believe that I could solve anything if I worked hard enough. I too have struggled with feelings of helplessness, as I watched dear ones slip away with illnesses that had no cure. My grandmother's dementia, my little brother's polio, and my sister's cancer. Today, polio is prevented, and cancer has better treatments. But we still face problems that have no solution, and dementia remains one of them. There are many ways to feel less helpless with this kind of loss, and I will share them with you. Instead of offering a how-to caregiving book, there are already many good ones. I've developed a new lens through which to make sense of your situation so that you can manage it and thereby feel stronger for this journey with dementia. How to listen to this book. This book is designed to be listened to alone or with a group. It is your guide for self-reflection, as well as discussion with others. Each chapter can stand alone and has its own topic. Listen to it in any way you wish. Although related themes run throughout the book, you may, if you are busy or exhausted, want to focus on only one chapter at a time. I hope you find the information useful and calming for what is likely to be a long and painful journey. Know that I do not discuss the illnesses and conditions that cause dementia, nor do I discuss the medical technicalities of dementia. Rather, I focus on the challenges you face relationally when someone you love has dementia. Here is a brief summary of the chapters, so that you can best decide which area to focus on as you listen. Chapter 1. The Ambiguous Loss of Dementia. Explains what ambiguous loss is, how it relates to you, and why it can cause depression and anxiety. Chapter 2. The Complications of Both Loss and Grief. Makes the case that unresolved loss causes unresolved grief. What this means for you is that your complicated grief is to be expected. It is not your fault. The complicated grief is caused by ambiguous loss, in this case, by the dementia, which requires a special kind of grieving. Chapter 3. Stress, Coping, and Resiliency. Helps you identify your own stress issues more specifically. Once you have done this, your coping can begin. Knowing what the problem is allows you to deal with it. How caregivers do this will differ depending on their beliefs and values. Chapter 4. The Myth of Closure. Tells you why closure is the wrong goal with dementia, and what you can learn from the many people who live comfortably without it. Many caregivers embrace the ambiguity rather than fight it. They offer much you can learn from about living with ambiguity and uncertainty. Chapter 5. The Psychological Family. Introduces the idea that you may have, in addition to your biological family, a family in your heart and mind. And this psychological family can be very comforting when you feel alone and isolated or overwhelmed. Chapter 6. Family Rituals, Celebrations, and Gatherings. Focuses on ways to help you stay connected to others while you are providing care. Human connection is essential to your well-being, and rituals are a way to make such connections regularly. Chapter 7. Seven Guidelines for the Journey is the core of the book. It provides guidelines for finding your way on your long and arduous journey with dementia. I intentionally use the term guidelines rather than tips or rules, because I want these ideas to be useful to a broader diversity of families and caregivers who have varying beliefs and values. Chapter 8, Delicious Ambiguity, presents the positive side of dementia's ambiguity. Without romanticizing the pain, seeing the good side gives you back some sense of control and takes away some of the terror. Chapter 9, The Good Enough Relationship, suggests that a good enough relationship can be good. In fact, most of us already have had such relationships, because loved ones are rarely fully present both physically and psychologically. That experience can help you now, as you experience your more extreme situation with dementia. Although each chapter contains separate ideas, there's overlap, so that you can review or listen to one chapter at a time. The common theme throughout is that you can find meaning in your changed relationship. Once you make sense of it, you can more easily discover new hope and peace, despite the stress of dementia's ambiguous loss. Chapter 1. The Ambiguous Loss of Dementia. how absence and presence coexist. The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. F. Scott Fitzgerald, The Crack-Up, 1945, page 69. Rarely in human relationships are people completely absent or present. For this reason, loss and ambiguity are core elements in the human experience. With dementia, however, they merge into what I call ambiguous loss. Ambiguous loss is a loss that is unclear. It has no resolution, no closure. This unique and devastating kind of loss can be physical or psychological, but in either case, a family member's status as absent or present remains hazy. Dementia creates ambiguous loss. The duality of your loved ones being absent and present at the same time is confusing, and finding meaning or making sense of your situation becomes immensely challenging. Without meaning, it's hard to cope. It's hard to manage even your day-to-day responsibilities. Ambiguous loss ruptures your relationship as you knew it. What you had before your loved one's dementia set in and the way you were together are now gone. With dementia, something is definitely lost. You feel it, but no one comes to you, as they do after a loved one dies, to validate or support your loss. People even say things like, "You're lucky, you still have your mate," or "You still have your parent," but you know you don't really. Healthcare professionals might distance themselves from you because you're not the patient, just the caregiver, making you feel even more confused and alone. None of the usual customs and rituals used to manage grief fit your kind of loss. You are on your own in a limbo that all too often goes unnoticed or denied by the larger community. Perhaps it is simply convenient for society to let unpaid family caregivers deal with dementia patients on their own. Or perhaps it's too troubling for others to see what they cannot fix. For many reasons, it takes extraordinary strength to be a caregiver. Gone, not gone. In my therapy practice, I worked with Jenny, who told me her husband was slowly slipping away into another world. She knew the diagnosis, dementia due to Alzheimer's, and realized that the journey would be long, years, maybe decades. But she was desperate to find some relief from her anger and confusion. She wanted her husband back. He'd been a successful businessman, a loving husband and father, but he was no longer the man she knew. Gone, but still there. The event that made Jenny reach out for help came when her husband of 40 years became short-tempered. He no longer treated her kindly. She said she felt as though there was a stranger in the house. This was not the relationship she wanted. She felt betrayed and abandoned. Such uncanny transformation brings shifts not only in relationships, but also in the way we see ourselves. Consider these difficult questions. Am I still married if my spouse doesn't know me anymore? Is he still a parent to our children if he doesn't know them anymore? Am I still the daughter if I am now mothering my mother, my father? People vary in how they answer such questions, but they all struggle with them. Jenny felt as if she were alone now, and thus obliged to rethink who she was. With deep sadness, she said, "I feel like I'm leaving the shore for an unknown place." Jenny was experiencing the loss of her husband's mind and memory, and also the relationship as it had been prior to his Alzheimer's diagnosis. He was with her physically, but virtually absent psychologically. This incongruence was confusing and painful. I told her that what she was experiencing was ambiguous loss, the most difficult kind of loss because there is no possibility of closure. Having a name for the problem, she could begin her coping process. We talked about possible choices. She might choose to act as if nothing were wrong, or going to the other extreme, as if he were already gone and out of her life. She said she had tried the former and couldn't do the latter. I suggested she consider the middle ground. "What is that?" she asked. "You can learn how to live with the ambiguity that comes with dementia." Although living with ambiguity is not an easy task in a culture that values certainty, Jenny chose to wrestle with not knowing what was coming next or how it would end. but now she understood that the culprit was neither her husband nor herself, but the illness. Dementia brings with it something mysterious that skews a relationship beyond human expectation. Knowing that it was not her fault, she was better able to begin coping, not to find a solution to the problem, but rather to live with the lack of solution and the unanswered questions. Loving half a person. In my therapy practice, I see many people like Jenny, women and men who come to me because they are at their wits' end trying to figure out what is happening to them and their relationship with someone they love. It is not just about the exhausting and lonely caregiving role, but also about how to make sense of the situation they now find themselves in, without losing who they are in the process. Regardless of its cause, dementia's ambiguous loss can debilitate even the healthiest of us. This is the struggle, making sense out of a nonsensical situation. You come to realize that life now is dramatically altered. Your loss is great, but there is no sympathy card. No one sits Shiva or holds awake. Instead, there is a lonely and oft misunderstood mourning, a chronic sadness, with an indefinite beginning and indefinite end. A New York psychologist who is also a caregiver, Carolyn Fagelson, asks a painful question. How is it possible to lose half a person? Half is dead, half remains alive. Unlike a fairy tale whose premise is poetic reality in which nothing can surprise the reader, the uncanny story violates the observer's trust in reality. To be sure, caregivers who live with ambiguous loss live with a reality that is broken and no longer trustworthy. Their loss is irrational, illogical, and absurd, and yet real. Whether dementia stems from illness or injury, the challenge is to embrace the ambiguity and confusion. This doesn't mean passively submitting or settling. Rather, it means discovering your choices and making decisions about how to find some continuity in the midst of chaos and change. It means trying to find some clarity in the midst of ambiguity. And live with ambiguity we must, if not earlier in life, then certainly as we grow older. Even in normal times, we are most often apart from those we love. I go to work in one place, my husband in another, and our children in yet another. Some are in other states, thousands of miles away. Friends are scattered around the globe. In this mobile society, most of us are separated from those we love most of the time. But contemporary families seem to take what dissonance there is between physical and psychological presence in stride. Is this because we know that we can come together again whenever we wish? Unlike with dementia, such loss is retrievable. We can fix the loss with an airplane ticket or phone call. There are, of course, obstacles that prevent reunions, such as cost, war, or political strife. Once we see how rare it is for couples and families to be fully present for one another, physically and psychologically, we realize that most of us already possess some skills for living with the ambiguity of separation and distance, and surviving it. This previous experience, albeit different, helps teach us how to survive loving someone with dementia. Finding the middle ground. With dementia, absence and presence coexist. Struggling too hard for clarity can lead to false answers that are attempts to erase the ambiguity. What I see most often is either premature closure, she's already dead to me, so I don't visit her anymore, or a denial that anything has been lost. He is just naturally forgetful, so he can still drive. Unless we consciously work hard to think about embracing ambiguity, any of us could quite easily fall into absolute thinking. This does not work with ambiguous loss and the real complexity you face. When someone you love has dementia, the task is to increase your tolerance for the stress of ambiguity. To begin doing this, work at learning how to hold two opposing views at the same time. My parent is here and not here. My mate is no longer the person I married, but still someone I love and will care for. Don't give up on loved ones when they are no longer able to be who they were. Paraphrasing F. Scott Fitzgerald, learning to hold two opposing ideas in your mind at the same time allows you to move to the middle ground instead of sticking with the extremes. In the case of dementia, rather than the unfortunate extremes of either denial or acting if the person were already dead and gone, there is a better choice. See absence.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?